to What She Said on 105.9 The Region. I'm your host, Candace Sampson. This week's show has some interesting timing, pun intended, with the clock springing forward and International Women's Day top of mind. But while the clocks might be moving ahead, not so much for women's rights. International Women's Day traces back to the early 20th century, the origins of which lie in the 1908 garment workers' strike in New York, where women protested against inhumane working conditions, marking a pivotal moment in the fight for women's rights. This act of defiance, coupled with the tragic Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in 1911, galvanized a worldwide movement, leading to the first National Women's Day in the U.S. in 1909 and the establishment of International Women's Day by the United Nations in 1975. So you would think that after more than 100 years, we would no longer need to be fighting for equality. But if we've learned anything in the last few years, it's that you can never let your guard down on women's rights. In the U.S., we've seen significant backslides, most notably in the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, a stark reminder of how quickly hard-won rights can be eroded. This isn't just an American issue. Canada is not immune either. Vigilance is required daily to ensure we don't lose any more ground than we already have, especially considering the setbacks experienced by many women during the pandemic. So as we move past the performative celebrations and corporations and politicians moving on to the next date in the calendar, I want to remind you that every day is International Women's Day here at What She Said. As usual, I've lined up some incredible interviews this week that look at our ongoing fight for equity, spotlight the women making significant strides, and discussing breaking free from the barriers that hold us back. I invite you to dedicate the next hour to yourself and join me in listening to these empowering conversations. Here's what's in store. I'm excited to launch a new 6-part series in partnership with the Pay Equity Commission of Ontario. Over the coming months, we'll tackle vital topics such as the gender wage gap, pay equity versus equal pay for equal work, the gender pension gap, and how to navigate employment law for women. Kicking off this series, Commissioner Katie Philp joins me for an introductory session on pay equity, laying the groundwork for our enlightening journey ahead. Anne Brody is in with an entertainment update, including the re-release of the documentary Navalny in select theaters across Canada, the riveting Cabrini, which tells the story of America's only saint, Mother Frances Cabrini, Guy Ritchie's new 8-part series, The Gentleman, on Netflix, starring the very handsome Theo James as a British aristocrat trying to break free from gangsters, and the always delightful Eugene Levy is back for a second season of The Reluctant Traveler. Alison Stratton, author of Unleadership, joins me to share 5 incredible Canadian leaders highlighted in her book. These women embody the true spirit of leadership and might just inspire you to follow in their footsteps. Plus, we have a giveaway of 10 copies of Unleadership over on Instagram, so stick around to find out how you can win a copy for yourself. And finally, to wrap up today's show, I'll be discussing the transformative power of personal growth with Shannon Talbot. Her new book, Breaking Free, is a journey through the trials and triumphs of self-discovery, offering actionable steps for those ready to overcome their obstacles and live with authenticity. Shannon, with her profound wisdom and compassionate guidance, will be joining me to illuminate the path to healing and fulfillment. And to add a little more excitement, we'll be giving away 10 copies of Breaking Free. What a week! Don't miss this chance to embark on a journey that could redefine the way you see yourself and the world around you. So make yourself comfortable and join me for an hour of inspiring stories and insightful discussions. Let's celebrate the spirit of International Women's Day together on What She Said, right here on 105.9 The Region. Thrilled to be kicking off a new 6-part series in partnership with the Pay Equity Commission of Ontario here on What She Said. We'll be exploring crucial topics over the next several months, including the gender wage gap, pay equity versus equal pay for equal work, the gender pension gap, and navigating employment law for women. Today, though, Commissioner Katie Philp joins me for a Pay Equity Commission 101 of sorts to set the foundation for this enlightening journey ahead. Welcome to What She Said, Katie.
Thank you for having me.
So here's a fun fact. Ontario was the first government globally to create a Pay Equity Act that covers workers in both the public and private sectors. So let's take it all the way back to the beginning. How did this happen?
That is a really fun fact. And I like to share that fact because that's not something a lot of people know. But our act came into force in the late 80s. And, you know, if you think about what was happening in the world in the 1980s, there was a lot, you know, we're talking about third wave feminism and a lot of sort of cultural zeitgeist around women's empowerment. You can think about, you know, the 9 to 5 film, infamous song, which is also linked to a union, the National Association of Working Women across the U.S. And so this film, this pop culture moment started to create this movement of women empowerment and women's equity movements in the workforce. And then you had other, you know, pop culture things like the Working Girl movie with Harrison Ford and Melanie Griffith. I don't know if you remember that, or even The Color Purple with Whoopi Goldberg.
One of my favorite movies.
Yes.
One of my favorite movies is Working Girl.
Yes. And when you think about it, you think like, well, why are we starting this conversation with pop culture? But that's because pop culture drives social discourse, and social discourse drives voter preferences and voter behavior. So governments are going to be responding to that. So there was this sort of zeitgeist moment where you have, you know, Cyndi Lauper singing Girls Just Want to Have Fun, Eurythmics, Sisters Are Doing It for Themselves, Donna Summer, She Works Hard for the Money, like Joan Jett, Bad Reputation, all these cultural things happening, changing the conversation around women and work and equity. And so, you know, the 80s was sort of this upbeat time and upbeat prospects about having a more equal society. And women were, they were advocating for themselves, for equality at work. They were also advocating for bigger social problems like poverty reduction, anti-racism movements, full inclusion movements. So there was this sort of cultural zeitgeist at the moment that I think allowed for the, I would say, the political will or the political motivation for governments to come together and say that this is a viable moment for us to create a piece of legislation. And that's actually what happened. You know, there was a unique moment in Ontario, at least. In 1985, we formed a coalition government that's never happened again. Maybe will never happen again between the NDP and Liberals. And part of that coalition's agreement was that they agreed to create a Pay Equity Act that covered a concept called equal pay for work of equal value, which we're going to keep talking about throughout this series because it's a concept that really defines what is pay equity. And so they moved really quickly. I mean, this coalition came together June 85. By November 85, they actually published a paper on what pay equity could look like in Ontario. That was November 85. By January 1986, they ran public consultations and then moved very quickly creating the legislation. It was first introduced late 1986. Obviously, when you introduce any piece of legislation of this sort and size, there's going to be debate, revisions, all of that fun stuff. But by essentially January 1st, 1988, we had a Pay Equity Act. And this was the first government globally to actually have a Pay Equity Act, as you said, that covered equal pay for work of equal value and applied to both the public and private sectors. So, you know, at the moment, I can't really emphasize how like momentous this was, not just for Ontario, but globally setting a new standard and a new precedent, because the Ontario Act brings together the sort of the best of or parts of HR law, compensation law, employment law, human rights, HR, I meant sort of previously human resources. So it's a really robust, rich act. And it came into force because of the political will at the time, but also I would say, you know, grassroots advocacy and the sort of pop culture zeitgeist where you saw a lot of conversations happening about women's empowerment.
I'm going to just go a little bit off topic here because it is Women's History Month. Any notable women we should be giving a shout out to thank for this incredible act?
Good question. I mean, it's hard to point to one woman or person because there were so many groups advocating for this. that it's hard to say, well, here's the person who led it, because it was just like, this was really a result, I would say, of 20 years of grassroots activism. Ursula Franklin was a professor at the U of T who published a lot of academic research in this space. And I know that our office in the early days leaned heavily on her research to help with the sort of policy formation. So, you've got to think of like the social activists and the journalists and everybody who was writing about this kind of created enough of a wave and a momentum to push it over the edge.
Yeah, I love looking at moments like this because it gives me hope for the future as well in creating these moments to change things that we don't like.
Exactly.
What is the purpose of the Pay Equity Act then? You know, what are the guiding principles that you follow?
That's a good question because, you know, simply or the policy language is that the purpose of the act is to redress systemic discrimination in compensation for work performed by employees in female job classes. And we'll get into that because that's kind of a little bit confusing. But, you know, it unapologetically recognized that the labor market had been sex segregated. There were certain jobs that men did and certain jobs women did. And the jobs that women tended to do were valued less in the economy for a lot of reasons we're gonna get into later in this conversation today, I'm sure. But also we'll get into this over the next six episodes that we have conversation with. But you know, that was the purpose, was to redress this like long-term systemic discrimination of jobs that were classified as or stereotyped as quote unquote women's work. There were some guiding principles that shape the way, you know, any policy has to have a framework and how it's going to operate. And a couple of things, you know, this policy regulates all employers across Ontario, which is a significant number of employers. We're talking in the tens of thousands. So it was designed to be, I would say, proactive and self-managed. So a founding principle is that workplaces actually bear the primary responsibility for eliminating gender-based pay discrimination. And this is a self-managed process. So every company has to go through and do a pay equity analysis and go through the audit process. So it's sort of like a thou shalt, you know, like here's the commandment, right? Go forth and do it. So it's proactive in that way. It's also reactive, though, because we respond to complaints. Workers across Ontario, regardless of gender, by the way, if you're in an occupation that's stereotyped or has historically or traditionally been held as a, you know, female job, you can apply under the Act. So understanding, though, that reactive nature is both part of it, because we proactively push this, but we also respond reactively to complaints from individuals in the labor market. We also recognize that, you know, there's obviously limited public resources to effectively enforce an act like this, right? So that is why we actually have that reactive, or I would say complaint-driven approach, because we educate employers and say, hey, it's your responsibility. It's incumbent on you to manage this process and create it. Well, we know they're not all going to do that. So we respond with a complaint-driven approach, and which is an effective way to manage enforcement when you have such a large employment and labor market that you have in Ontario that we're regulating. You know, we've also, the Pay Equity Act was founded on, I would say, best practices in terms of legislation, which understands that if you give workplace parties, so especially, you know, unions and labor representation to work together to resolve disagreements on their own, you're likely going to see more effective outcomes for everyone. And so the Act allows for that. So there's an important piece there where I think that, you know, especially Ontario has a highly high rate of unionization. So allowing for unions and employers to negotiate amongst themselves and come up with a pay equity plan and strategy that works, that obviously is in line with the law, is a really effective way to do this. I would say the founding principle is also gender neutrality. We have a lot of ways of looking at and sort of degendering jobs as sort of like bias thread that was put on them. And so gender neutrality in terms of doing job evaluation, and we create a lot of tools and we educate employers on how to actually do that. And, you know, finally, we focus on equal pay for work of equal value, which acknowledges that, you know, men and women have done different work over time because of sex-based discrimination. But we valued certain jobs more than others. And so the Act seeks to redress that and say, let's actually get down to, we can compare apples and oranges. We're not talking about two people on a unaligned moving widgets. We're talking about people doing different jobs in an organization, but maybe one is undervalued because it's been dominated by women.
We're going to take a quick break. We're just speaking with Commissioner Katie Philp about the Pay Equity Commission, and we'll be right back after this commercial break.
More with Candace Sampson and What She Said coming up on 105.9 The Region. Welcome back to What She Said with Candace Sampson on 105.9 The Region.
Okay, we're back with Commissioner Katie Philp from Pay Equity Commission of Ontario. We're discussing the Pay Equity Commission Act. Katie, this act is 37 years old, almost as old as me.
Me too. Me too.
So, but you know, some might say the labor market has changed a lot in 37 years. So does it still serve its purpose?
Yes, it does. I mean, obviously I'm going to say that, but it does. You know, the labor market has changed a lot. And even if you think about the last 50 to 100 years, I won't, you know, go through all that. We don't have the time. But, you know, as I've already mentioned, post-war industrialization, 1930s, jobs were highly sex segregated. And there was actually laws participating, or limiting, I should say, participation for both men and women. You know, women did certain types of jobs, men did other jobs. But mostly women were affected by these jobs because there were, you know, laws that said that limited working hours for women in order to give men more, or to protect, you know, what was understood as the sensibilities of women at the time, or limited sectors they could work in. Or in fact, even in the 1970s, in some of the US states and Canada, we had marrying teacher laws that said if you were a teacher and you got married, you had to resign. So, you know, there's legal frameworks that that have mostly, okay, first of all, there's legal frameworks that created these sort of inequalities. And yes, most of them are gone. By and large, they're gone. However, the legacy of those persists. And that takes time. It takes time to have a cultural and economic shift. And if you think about it, men and women have only been working together for about 70 years. Like, that's when the desegregation really started to break down. And so obviously it's going to take time. And we have seen noticeable progress in breaking down segregation, women moving into more male-dominated spheres, men moving into more female-dominated spheres. So as we break down that clustering, that's great, but we're not quite there yet. And so the Act continues to serve that purpose of addressing it.
And you touched on this a little bit, but, you know, I think it's really important to sort of drive this point home. It's not this, the Pay Equity Commission is not just for women.
Right. No, it's not. It's for every employee.
Yeah. So you serve, and especially I think non-binary workers, people who identify as trans. I know that trans people in particular have a really hard time finding employment. So you help these people as well, right?
The Act applies to every worker. What we look at is the gender of a job class. So as I said, you know, because of the kind of highly sex segregated labor market that was created with the advent of the Industrial Revolution and the paid labor market, jobs were gendered, male and female. And that's largely because the, you know, the social discourse in the 18th, 19th century was male, female, and we had this very binary workforce. And that is what persists today. So it's not about the gender of the person, it's, or their gender identity. It's about the gender and gender identity of the job class, or the way that it has been gendered over time. And thankfully, the gender's sort of segregation is breaking down, which is good. When we see that disappearing is maybe when the Act starts to be irrelevant, because it means we're starting to reach parity. But at this point, you know, we still have predominantly the lingering of the predominantly male and female job classes. And I hope we never get to a day where we, you know, see the creation of non-binary or trans job classes, because that means we have failed as a society and as a labor market. Because that would mean that certain individuals are clustered into certain jobs based on their gender identity. And so we don't see that happening right now. We still see the persistence of predominantly male and female gender job classes. And so anybody can apply. We've had men apply. We've had non-binary individuals apply. We've seen the whole spectrum of personal identities apply. But what matters in the process is how the job class has been gendered. We look at current incumbency. We look at the historical incumbency of that job class. And then, of course, the stereotype, how it is viewed in society. And we use that as our basis. So absolutely, the Act can serve all working Ontarians.
Katie, you are always sharing great information on the website, but you also, there's ways for people to get in touch with you there. Can you share best places for people to find you and to follow along with what you are sharing on social media?
We are very active. We have a strong LinkedIn community. So I think people can look up Pay Equity Office of Ontario on LinkedIn and join us and follow us. We share a lot of information there. We have a great podcast series. If your listeners want to learn more, levelthepayingfield.ca. And of course, payequity.on.gov.ca is a great spot to get all our information.
All right. Incredible. I'm going to put that all these links in the blog post when this goes live on whatshesaidtalk.com. And we will see you next month.
Excellent. Thank you.
It's time for Saturday Night at the Movies with Anne Brody, and we're kicking off with a kind of heavy documentary this week about Navalny.
Yes. Well, Cineplex has decided to re-release the Oscar-winning documentary made by Canadian filmmaker Daniel Rohr in theaters, select theaters. It's a tribute to the Russian activist who was Putin's fiercest critic. And of course, as you know, he died on February 16th in a Siberian prison under mysterious circumstances, being seen the prior day, completely healthy, laughing and talking. So he was the official opposition. And as you know, Putin has a way of getting rid of people who oppose him. He'd already been poisoned in 2020. And he recovered in Germany, and he worked with Bellingcat, which is a tremendous website, and CNN to make the documentary, which we can now see again. And I think it's important just to know what drove him and why he decided to make that fateful decision to go back to Russia.
Yeah, he was an incredibly brave man. Mm. And I have to tell you, I think Putin should be shaking in his boots with his wife, because Julia Navalny has been coming out recently since her husband's death and has been quite outspoken. And I'm going to watch this documentary, not just to learn about him, but to learn more about her, because she is really, I think, the epitome of grace under pressure.
No,
she
kidding.
Is just amazing.
Yes. I'm so happy that she's doing this. I'm sure her family is not particularly, but Putin needs to be exposed. We all know, but they don't know. The Russians don't know. And they keep voting, quotation marks.
Yes. Well, in air quotes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like a great documentary. So I'm thrilled that they're actually sharing that again in theaters, mm-hmm. Anne. The next one we have looked really good to me. This is fascinating. Cabrini. Tell me about this.
You know, it is good. When I said, oh, this is about America's only saint, I thought, well, you know, it might be a bit of a propaganda thing, but it's not. It's a very straightforward film from Alejandro Monteverdi, and it concerns an Italian nun, Mother Francesca Cabrini, who moved to New York in 1899, and she was horrified by the number of orphan children running around the streets with nowhere to go, no education, no prospects, no one looking after them. So she decided then and there that she would create a home for them. The mayor, the chief of police, they were anti-Italian racists. They turned her down at every stage. Eventually, she got money and she was able to build a series of homes across the U.S. And when she died in 1917, she'd created 67 missionary institutions around the world, if you can imagine.
Yeah, amazing.
So she's connected with two miracles. And so she was sainted in 1938 and canonized in 1946. You know, the film is straightforward. It's a drama. It's not a documentary. It's not sentimental. It's not over the top in any way. Very good film.
Speaking of over the top, I want to talk about the gentleman from Guy Ritchie. And here, I just want to have to say this out loud. Theo James is not hard on the eyes.
Oh, no, he's not. How does he compare to Harrison Ford for you?
Well, you know, nobody can beat Harrison Ford. Right. But I will say I will be watching just for him because it does look, it looks really entertaining. And also he is very handsome.
Yes, he's very handsome. And you'll see him just looking at, you know, into the distance, looking handsome quite a bit. So he's got a big problem. He's a military guy in the Middle East, British, and his parents were lords and ladies. He comes back home to the stately mansion for his father's funeral, and he inherits the whole works, going over the eldest son, who's a drug addict and a total loser. So anyway, he inherits all these properties, but there he has no money, and he's £8 million in debt. So he discovers that there's a bit of a business going on underneath the castle, a massive grow-op, and it's run by very colorful characters, including Vinnie Jones, who's just a tremendous English bad guy thug actor, and the same with Harry Winstone. So he looks into it. He sees, okay, I can make some money. He starts to you know, be okay with it, even though he's a military man. But I'm telling you, the hijinks, the twists, the craziness that defines Guy Ritchie is all there. It is so much fun. It's just a blast.
It really looks like it. So I'm looking forward to that. That's on Netflix, right, Anne?
Netflix, yes.
All right, perfect. All right, last one. I think we just have to touch on it quickly because I just adore him. He is everybody's favorite. Eugene Levy is back.
He is. He's got The Reluctant Traveler season 2, and he claims he's easier with traveling now. So you think, yeah, not what we saw in season 1. But, you know, he is braver. And there's this funny, funny scene early on. He's paddling a kayak in Sweden. He says, I've been up a few creeks in my time, but at least I have a paddle here. So he's smiling more. He's visiting a ton of countries. He's smiling more. He's relaxed. He's the life of the party, even in some places. Oh, a palace near Balmoral. And then he has a lunch with a very testy Joan Collins in Saint-Tropez. And she's not an appealing character from the looks of it. But it's a fun, fun story. One serious thing is when he's in Scotland and he visits his mother's tenement where she grew up in Glasgow. So that's kind of emotional. But the rest of it, you know, it's Eugene Levy being Eugene.
It's absolutely wonderful. Yeah, he is. He's delightful. I love it. This is a great roundup this weekend. All really good shows that I want to watch. And so
good.
You have all of these and more over on whatshesaidtalk.com. And we'll see you next week.
We'll see you next week.
You know, I don't understand why it's so plain. But you can't be good to me. Why can't you be?
More with Candace Sampson and What She Said coming up on 105.9 The Region. Welcome back to What She Said with Candace Sampson on 105.9 The Region.
I'm special. So special. I got half some of your attention. Give it to me.
I'm happy to be welcoming back Allison Stratton, the brilliant co-author of Unleadership, Make Building Relationships Your Business. Allison, along with her dynamic partner in life and work, Scott Stratton, has been navigating the seas of business in our ever-turbulent age of disruption with a compass firmly set on the true north of relationships in marketing, sales, and branding. In celebration of International Women's Day, Allison is joining me to highlight 5 incredible female leaders featured in Unleadership and what it is about them that makes them worth talking about. Allison, welcome back to the show.
I'm so excited to be here. I think all women, Canadian women entrepreneurs, are women worth talking about. I felt really lucky to be researching the book and have a chance to speak to so many Canadian women. I actually spoke to, I think it was 13 or 14 in total of the 50 people, 52 people we interviewed are Canadian women. So I was very proud of that. And also, one of the things that was interesting for the book was how many of the leaders we spoke to, which might say more about the people who are looking for the leaders, but how many of the leaders who weren't women, who called themselves feminists and spoke about work and leadership and ways to make women's experiences better in work. So it was actually really inspiring and encouraging to see so many people and women talking about how to make work life better for women in Canada.
And, you know, I think too, Allison, there's just like this trope that goes around that women are gossips and we talk about each other behind our back. And I hate that stereotype. And I want to talk about women full out in the open and let's build them up and get them in front of other people so that other people can seek them out. So we sort of, we chose five people to talk about today, all great people. So Allison, who is the first person we're going to gossip about? I'm putting that in air quotes, but who are we going to talk about first?
Let's talk about Cheyenne Sundance first. So Cheyenne was actually someone who I reached out to interview for the book. I've been a big fan of hers for a long time. There's probably a little like fangirling involved. I saw her on Instagram. She had this really compelling way, young farmer talking about agriculture in Canada, talking about food insecurity and food justice. And I actually ended up being a customer and we got like the organic box from her farm. So she's a cooperative farmer and the co-founder of Sundance Commons and also president of the BIPOC caucus for the National Farmers Union of Canada, which is a caucus that she actually fought to found. And I was just really dazzled by her. I mean, I just feel like food justice is so important and agriculture is such a male-dominated thing, right? Like she through her work, she's taught classes on farming for young people, things like teaching how to ride a tractor, how to do compost, like all these really practical things that lead to more food justice where people have more access to land and to agriculture and to understanding where their food comes from and what the food system looks like and how we can really find ways to, you know, just disrupt that whole system and grow food, support small farmers, support cooperative farming, and also just about leadership, like cooperation and collaboration are such kind of buzzwords and powerful terms in leadership. But cooperative farming really is collaborative, where you're sharing your strengths, you're letting others help you with your weaknesses. And so I learned a lot about leadership from Cheyenne, for sure.
I think the pandemic really moved a lot of people towards this, you know, learning how to grow their own food and where our food comes from. And, you know, as we're seeing with food prices, you know, we really will be seeking out these cooperative farmers. It's going to be a much bigger thing in the future. I want to move on to our next person we're going to chat about, because this is obviously something that's near and dear to what she said, and that is gender and sexual diversity.
Yeah, so I spoke with Debbie Owusu-Acha, who's the executive director of the Canadian Center for Gender and Sexual Diversity. And what was interesting about talking to Debbie was she was recommended by Faye Johnstone, who is another woman who you've interviewed on your show. And whenever I spoke to someone, I always want to know who influences them, right? Like, I know it never ends at the person. I want to know who are the leaders you look up to. And so when I spoke to Faye, she named Debbie and a few other women as well as someone who'd been really foundational to her understanding of leadership, because Faye had worked for Debbie in the past. And so Debbie joined as executive director. Think about this. It was the height of the pandemic. So imagine starting a new job at the height of the pandemic. And she was only 28. So she enters into this big organization as executive director, young, and also all kinds of transformation and change happening, right? We're in the middle of a pandemic. And she talked about a lot about listening. So she talked a lot about going in and listening to everyone. She talked a lot about making space, making room for voices, making opportunities for people, for younger leaders to be able to engage with their community in meaningful ways. This meaningful engagement was sort of a theme that kept coming up over and over, that leadership really looks for ways not only to just sort of like blast out connections like AI or like kind of like automate everything, but to find connections that are meaningful. And that was really an important leadership lesson, I think, from Debbie.
Absolutely. Truly inspiring and obviously a great organization as well. So who are we talking about next? Because I think we're heading into science a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So I spoke with May-Deanne Andrade. And May-Deanne is the, so she's actually a professor of biological sciences at the University of Toronto in Scarborough. And some of the stuff she shared with me was about building better futures for Black scientists and students at U of T, but also across Canada. She was part of founding TIDE, which is the Toronto Initiative for Diversity and Equity, and also the Canadian Black Scientist Network. So that's across Canada, impacting across Canada. One of the things that May-Deanne really spoke about was using research. So she knew that there was a problem and she wanted to form an organization, form a connection among Black scientists and really make the world better for future scientists. And so she used this research, used this knowledge that she had to show the university that this was needed, to show the university that here are the steps we can take to make the experience for Black students better at the University of Toronto. And that was one of the key lessons in leadership for me from May-Deanne, was just about using knowledge and how we can use knowledge as leaders to create great experiences and better experiences for people.
There is so much we can learn from these incredible women and leaders. The next person we're gonna chat about, though, I think every girly girl is going to recognize the name of this one, Jen Harper from Cheekbone Beauty. The world seems obsessed with her products right now.
What is so funny about getting to speak to Jen is that I don't wear makeup at all. I'm embarrassing. I'm very embarrassing. But my daughter loves Cheekbone. And it was my daughter who first started sending me Jen's stuff on Instagram saying, like, you have to like check this out. They're in Sephora's Canadian company. And so I reached out to Jen, and Jen has an incredible story about founding Cheekbone, about it starting with a dream that she had and how she's grown the company. And for me, speaking with Jen, it was really about how she spoke about entrepreneurs being able to shape the kind of company that they want to build. Like, if you're an entrepreneur, you know, like, the best thing, it's not the work hours and it's not always the pay, but you get to have flexibility and you get to shape the work environment, who you work with, and what work looks like. What does it feel like to go into work? And leadership is really about that. It's like a social contract where you say, I'm going to decide what it feels like to work here. And what does that mean and how you can shape it? And so she talked about how compassion and humility aren't qualities that we always consider with leadership, but that they should be, which I think is so true. And she also talked about how they're built on three pillars. Their indigenous roots define their vision and are fundamental to everything they do. Second is environmental sustainability, which is part of being indigenous. And third, they try to keep bold, clean colors in everything that they do. And these three pillars, which are tied to her indigenous roots, have shaped everything from the customer experience to what it feels like to walk into work in the morning if you work at Cheekbone, to what it feels like to see her Instagram stories or her TikToks, like to see what she's like online, you know. And that's the kind of leadership that I feel like women really bring forward. We really wanted to disrupt this idea that emotions have no place at work. Mm-hmm. And I love when leadership is relationship focused, when it's emotions focused, what is it going to feel like? And getting to use that in a really powerful way.
Yeah, I think we're all tired of these big, greedy companies out there. We're exhausted. And so it's nice to see that it's not just Cheekbone Beauty, it's Backbone Beauty, because she's standing up for the right things. And, and she could totally use that little clip if she'd like. I'm going to try and get her on the show. I do love Cheekbone Beauty.
You absolutely. And she's phenomenal to speak to. And she, all of these women, it was transformational to speak to all of them. Like, I really felt honored, honestly, to have their time and for them to share their expertise for the book. And I love the idea of people reading it and seeing that you can have a dream like Jen did and use your values, root yourself authentically in who you are, what's important to you, and build something that becomes a company and that becomes something that inspires girls all across Canada, not only Indigenous girls, but many girls in Canada, to build a company like Jen did. And I love that. It inspired me.
Absolutely. And we're just going to hit on our last person here. And I think this is so topical. So it's kind of perfect. She's an MD and a burnout expert.
Yeah. Dr. Susan Bialy-Haas. First of all, she's absolutely lovely. She's out west in BC. I hope you'll be able to speak with her. So she was a doctor. She speaks very openly about her experience through school and as a doctor, really causing her trauma. And she shared some very personal stuff in the book about that trauma and about how she got so burned out herself. And she really wanted to be able to connect with her patients as a doctor in a way that allowed for growth beyond the, you know, the 15-minute time in the little room, which can be very intimidating and uncomfortable. And so she started doing sort of like coaching with people and looking at more a holistic view of health. And burnout became something that she couldn't not focus on, from her own experience with burnout personally to seeing what has become really an epidemic in the workplace and wanting to do something about it. And so she shared with us key points, not only about how leaders can take better care of themselves, which is important, of course, but also being a leader is a responsibility. And so what can leaders do with that responsibility to help all of the people who work for them so that burnout is less of a problem systemically in their companies? And she shared things like making sure that you have rewards that are the right kind of rewards, like that you're rewarding someone in a way that is meaningful for your employees. So is the reward like a bonus that they want? Or is it, you know, an extra, you know, work event on a Saturday where everyone has to do sports or something or touch a, you know, like something terrible? So just even meaningful rewards, it seems silly, but it is so important to know the people you work for, that leadership is about relationships. And so she talks about that in the book. And I really think it was actually a chapter that we gave away for free. So I'll share a link with you so that anyone listening can also read the chapter for free. I thought the advice she shared was so valuable that we thought everyone should read it. So I'll share that with you so you can share with your listeners. And yeah, a great Canadian woman as well, really making changes in the workplace overall in Canada and internationally with her work.
So obviously these are just a few of the women highlighted in Unleadership, and you are eager to get this book into the hands of a lot of Canadian women so we can inspire women across the country to embrace these leadership ideals. So you have 10 copies that we're going to be giving away to listeners. And all they have to do is hop on over to Instagram, find the post at What She Said Talk Instagram. And what are they going to do, Allison, to win a copy?
One of the big things about leadership is it can seem a little bit intimidating, right? Like we talked to all these incredible people. Think about the women just we talked about today. No one thought I should be, everyone's so humble, like, you sure you want to interview me? And meanwhile, I'm like, please, please talk to me for 5 minutes, you know, please. So what would be really great is just to hear who is a woman in your life or in your work life, or even someone who you don't know who just inspires you with their work. They don't have to be like some recognized person. They don't have to have a big title. You know, we really need to look for, leaders are often uncelebrated. The real leaders who do the work on the ground, who often are women, by the way, tend to be ignored. So celebrate someone in your life whose leadership really inspires you, and we'll send you books.
All right. Fantastic. Allison, thank you so much for joining me. And where can they find the book, actually? If anybody's looking for the book and they want to follow you, where can they do that?
Well, the book is now available wherever fine books or ones like ours are sold. But if you go to unleadershipbook.com, you can get more information about the book. You can see all the different people that we interviewed for it. And you can find links to all kinds of booksellers who have it. Indigo has it. Everywhere books are sold.
Fantastic. Allison, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. And happy International Women's Day to you.
Life is a journey of self-discovery and personal transformation, yet it's often laden with unseen hurdles and moments that test our resolve. These moments of frustration often spark a desire to seek answers and break free from the hang-ups and traumas that hold us back. Thankfully, there is a guide from us. Breaking Free by Shannon Talbot is more than just a book. It's a compass for those navigating the choppy waters of personal growth, offering insights into how we can overcome obstacles and live a life true to ourselves. Shannon joins me today to share her wisdom and experiences, shedding light on how we can all embark on a path of healing and self-discovery. Shannon, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Candace, for having me.
So your book is a powerful call to action for personal transformation. Can you share a key moment or realization that set you on this path?
So I think the biggest moment for me was I'd been living this, you know, life in the corporate world, balancing motherhood, ambition, all of these things. And every time I got a new role, starting with wife, then people manager, then later mom, I put these heavy expectations on myself. I told myself I had to act a certain way, be a certain way, and I started holding pieces of myself back. And I also never really learned to prioritize my well-being. I never learned to manage my stress and anxiety. And I was just kind of, you know, going through the motions of chasing my what I thought would make me successful and happy, which were like money and titles and all of those things. And then about a few years ago, I was pushing my then five-year-old on a swing in a park at lunchtime during COVID. And he said to me, "Mommy, can I give you a goal this year?" And I was really excited. I was doing my coaching certifications on the side while working in the corporate world. And so I said, "Yeah, bud, give me a goal. What's your goal for me?" And he said, "Mommy, can you be less angry this year? You are angry. Angry all the time."
Yeah. Wow.
And it wasn't the goal I was expecting, but it was what I needed to hear in that moment, because I realized in that moment that I wasn't living the life that I had dreamt of living when I was younger, that I wanted to be living. And so in that moment, I gave myself permission to break free, and as I like to call it, chase my happy. And I, you know, a few months later, gave my notice at work and started my own business where I do speaking and coaching, and then wrote this book as part of the journey as well.
Many of my listeners might be feeling stuck or unsure of how to start their journey of self-discovery. What's the first step you'd recommend to someone ready to make a change, but not sure where to even begin?
Sure. So I think the first step starts with letting yourself dream. Like, what is that vision? What did you, and you know, in the book I talk about, I had two secret silly dreams when I was in high school that I had told myself, nope, those aren't practical. Those aren't real careers. You can't do that, Shannon. And it wasn't until I started to give myself permission to let myself dream and revisit, like, what does light me up? What are those things? And you may not know the job, the industry, or the hobbies, or any of that, but just letting yourself maybe go back to when you were young and thinking about what brings you joy, what energizes you, and how can you get more of that in your life?
In Breaking Free, what do you hope people walk away with after reading the book?
I hope they walk away knowing that, like, they are in charge of their lives, of their careers, and it is up to them, right, to go after what they want, and that they can go after what they want. And the book gives you the practical step-by-steps of, and plus inspiring stories of how to do so. But really, I just want everyone to know, you do deserve joy and happiness in your life, and you can go out and get it.
We recorded a longer podcast on this, and I really encourage people to go over and listen to the entire podcast. But you broke the book down into sections. Can you explain those to people, what they look like?
Sure. So the first section is what lights us up. So really, you know, getting that vision, getting that idea of what, you know, what you're looking for, where, you know, how to get unstuck. What is that vision that's going to get you to feel better in your career or life? The second piece is what holds us back. So there I talk about, you know, all the different things that hold us back in lives, our BS, our excuses, our fears, the stories we tell ourselves, and our bad habits. And then we go into what sets us free. So what are the different components that make up having to go after what you want in your life and your career, and the different steps there? And then the last section is what keeps us going. So, you know, what are the ways we can sustain new habits or go after things and keep them going in our lives when perhaps maybe things go off the track and or we fall off the horse?
And I think it's important to note too that you actually give people assignments to do throughout this whole book.
Yes. Yeah. There are exercises in the book that for anyone who goes and gets the book, I strongly encourage you to do them. And I know what you're going to say. You're going to say, oh, they look silly or ridiculous. They're going to take too much time. It's going to feel like opening a can of worms. But if you do the work, you can set yourself free even more. And it's amazing the results that can come from doing the exercises.
I love it. I want people to be able to connect with you and, you know, keep up with all you're doing. You do have a new book on the horizon as well that so people, that if they follow along, they'll be in tune with that. So where can they keep up with you?
Sure. So you can go to my website at shannontalbot.com. I actually have a weekly email I send out on Sunday evenings with tips and tricks. So you can sign up for that there. You can find me on LinkedIn where I do a lot of posting, Shannon Talbot, or on Instagram, Shannon Talbot_coaching.
Okay, wonderful. I'm going to put all those links in the blog post that goes live on whatshesaidtalk.com after this airs on the radio and podcast. And thank you so much for joining me today, Shannon.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's it for What She Said this week. Stay up to date with our newsletter by signing up at whatshesaidtalk.com and be sure to follow on social at What She Said Talk on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for videos of these interviews and more. You can also catch me on TikTok at Candace Said. Finally, be sure to subscribe to What She Said with Candace Sampson on Apple and Spotify to catch past episodes and extended podcasts. I'll be back next week with another What She Said on 105.9 The Region.
Previous episodes of What She Said on 105.9theregion.com.